Blog Talk Radio.
We're done and out. The mess is over at all.
My main point here is that none of us should get into this dialogue of my slave master was better than your slave master, inasmuch as all of them were bad. But each one of us had to deal with a given situation, and all of the situations were bad, and all of the situations were humiliating, and none of the slave masters were kind, and none of them did us any favor, and none of them favored one over the other. And understand that the slave ships did not bring any black Americans or any Caribbeans out of Africa. They were only African people, and all of them had to become what the system made them become. And so we have to understand that all of us belong to a collective African family away from home. Then subsequently, we are going to have to go back home or make some kind of contribution to Africans in Africa. All right, that's not my point. That's not the subject for tonight, but it is a subject that we cannot avoid. All right, now, why the emphasis on Africa and the rise of Christianity? And I'll tell you how I came to the subject briefly. Because I learned to read very early, because I wanted to teach Sunday school in a Baptist church, and because I had, I was under the persuasion of a great lady, my great grandmother, one of the great loves of my existence, because she was devoutly religious and a believer in the Bible to the point of saying everything in the Bible is true and not to be contradicted. And when I found all those white images and went to Grandma, Grandma said, "Shut up, boy. That's God's word." When I mentioned the curse and ask the question, what did we do as a people to get cursed? She rationalized it and said that, well, one day the veil will be lifted and we'll be freed of the curse. I could not deal with this because I had so much faith in her and her deep religious belief that everything in the Bible was true. I had not grown up, of course. I had not read books about how the Bible got written. I did not know at that time how to separate history from Jewish folklore. I did not know that principally the Bible is a Jewish survival book and a very good one, and that some of it is pure history, some of it is pure folklore, but all of it is spirituality. And we must understand, all of it was told as a spiritual story and for the spiritual enhancement of all men. I had not at that time looked at the Egyptian version and the Ethiopian version of the Bible. It was not until the late 30s that I saw an Ethiopian Bible, and in the Ethiopian Bible there was only one white character, and that was the devil. I had not at that time been exposed to all of that are the literature concerning the religions of the world. I saw that Africa was the basis of all the three major world religions. What I want to look at, I want to look at not only Africa as the basis of the world's religions, I want to look at the spirituality of the world of that day before the formal development of these religions. Because these religions were developed out of the spirituality that existed at the time. And that the spirituality at the time and the religions at the time was not a weekend thing. It was an all-conclusive thing that it embraced the life of its inheritance. To such an extent, your religion determined your dress, your marriage, your diet. It determined where you lived. It determined the totality of your life. And it was not a partial thing in your life. It was a total thing in your life as your choice of spirituality supposed to be. Western man made it something that it was never intended to be. Now, my main point is that all of the elements that went into the making of the world's three major religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of the elements existed in Africa 3,000 years before the formal development of these religions. We want to look at these elements and look at these stories. Then we want to deal with the Hebrew interest and to what extent they copied African folklore and made this folklore a part of their history. And the same folklore hasn't existed in Africa for thousands of years before they arrived. Now, what you have to look at also is the fact that we are talking about a period in the history of the world when there was no such thing as Europe. It's hard for you to believe this, and it is hard for you to understand that for most of the existence of the world, for most of the time, man has been functioning in the world, there was no such place as Europe. Now, we're looking at civilizations that existed before the creation of a place in northern Asia called Europe. That is not a continent. What you have to understand is the impact of the glacial age. And the glacial age hit Europe. For most of the existence of these early civilizations, Europe was an ice cap and was uninhabited. It was only after the melting of this ice that people could go into Europe and form a civilization or a way of life. And these first people were Africans. Now, you're wondering, how did they become white? Well, it's a longer story that we can tell. But nature endows man and woman with the covering they need when nature put them down. And nature subtracts from man and woman things that they do not need in the climate and in the environment where nature put them down or where they choose to dwell. All right, now, Christianity developed out of African humanistic values and social thought. These humanistic values and social thought was old in Africa and remained in Africa for thousands of years before someone gave the religion a name. In other words, there was probably more Christianity before someone decided that it should have a name and they put a name on it. Now, this is reflected in a lot of literature, some written by our own writers, John Jackson's Pagan Origins of the Christ Myth, where he traces the concept of Christ in 26 civilizations, all 1,000 miles apart. In another work, Man, God, and Civilization, and another pamphlet, The African Origins of Christianity, and his new work, only out a few months ago, Christianity Before Christ. Now, the unfortunate thing about a book like Christianity Before Christ is that a lot of people will read the title, be intrigued with the title, and little afraid to read the book. And yet, he has treated the subject with great delicacy and with great respect. All he has done is to point out that all of the elements that ultimately went into the making of Christianity existed in Africa before Christ, and someone came along and a set of circumstances made man formalize those elements and give it a name. Now, that is not disrespectful of the religion at all. It is a tracing of the origins of the religion to African sources, Nile Valley sources, mainly Ethiopia and the nations in the Nile Valley. We're not emphasizing Egypt alone, because Egypt alone was not the producers of this great civilization. A complex of nations in the Nile Valley produced this civilization and produced the religion. The concept of worship and the concept of a single God first appeared in Ethiopia. But the formalization of the concept would later appear in Egypt during the period of Akhenaten. All right, now, my point is that in looking at the religion, we have to look at the history at the same time. And we have to look at some of the literature around it, especially John Jackson's work, Ethiopia in the Origins of Civilization, and the Pagan Origins of the Christ Myth, and other works, including the later work on the African origins of Christianity. All right. He shows also how this religion spread to India, spread to other parts of the world, and took on different names, and these deities appeared under other guises. All right, now, the formalization of these religions
of this religion and this religion functioning side by side with other religions brought no conflict at this time in history, none of the conflict that we see today. And we see it first taking shape in Ethiopia and moving down the Nile. In the fortunate circumstance of its birth and its development before someone gave it a name, if there was no pressure or agitation about it in this setting. There was no Asian, there was no European, and the Africans wasn't fighting over it, and they granted each other the choice of choosing one aspect of it than another. But the Africans had already begun to develop the main aspect that would go into their spiritual life.
An aspect that still goes into African spiritual life, if you visit the villages, you will not see it in the cities, but you will see it today in the villages. And that is bringing life in harmony with nature. And when we look at life today in the Western world is out of harmony with nature. It makes no sense. It makes no sense for one man to have enough bread to feed a multitude and to hold up the multitude. It makes no sense. There's a lack of balance. But Africans had a society where each man gave and each man had according to his needs. Now this was a form of social living that predates the concept of socialism. This is what Karl Marx misunderstood, and this is what the Marxists still misunderstood, and this is what they stupidly call primitive communism. It wasn't primitive at all. It was advanced, and it was Christian. Because they say religion is the opiate of the people, they can't deal with the fact that these early societies in their spirituality was a total thing. And religion wasn't the opiate of the people. Religion was part of the totality of the society and part of the day-by-day spirituality of the society, and it determined everything. It was only in the emptiness of Europe. It was only under feudalism. It was only in the misuse of the church. It was only in this regard, the hustlerism of the European church, that they turned it into the opiate of the people. But religion was never intended to be the opiate of the people. And this is why the Europeans had no understanding of the non-European mind, of the non-European spirituality. These early religions were not hurriedly brought into being or hurriedly changed. They stayed in fact for years. So the basic thing about these religions was to create balance in society, and a respect for the law of God. If you have a God, you have to have a God.
Yes.
Here you have the first female ecologist. Here you have the first female gods of history. Baal Hathor.
Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings. This is just doing a special short version of the cows. Wanted to speak with Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. about homosexual activity. I was able to speak with him privately last week, and he shared some really interesting thoughts, and I wanted him to share that with you all briefly. I didn't want to take up too much of his time. Mr. Fuller, when I spoke with you, you said that white people tend to think of non-white people as boys and girls, and you tied that into how that relates to homosexual behavior. Could you share that with our audience so they can get a really clear picture of what you're saying?
Well, there is a system of white supremacy in place, which just means just mistreatment and domination and use of people in a royalist manner based on color. That's basically what it is. That's what racism is. It's just a variation of the of royalism, but it's based on color rather than on other things like lineage and who your father was and what your name was, I mean, 1,000 years ago, and certain sets of traditions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what basically racism is, and it's turned out to be the most powerful form of royalism in the known universe now in the form of what we call racism and or white supremacy. Now, in any structure that's dominant, you have to dominate the people in all areas of activity. If you don't dominate them in all areas of activity, then other areas of activity will slip away from the domination factor. And you have 9 areas, according to what I have written, that would just about cover most things. I think that's adequate enough. Economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. Now, I call sex the 8th area of activity in alphabetical order of the other areas of activity. So that just comes up as number 8. But sex is the most powerful motivating force among people, next to the system of white supremacy itself. Because whatever the dominant system is, that's what people react to on the planet. So the dominant system at this particular time in history, and has been as far back as anybody can remember who's breathing now, the dominant system, that's mistreatment of people based on color, domination of people based on color. So the sexual aspect is the second most powerful motivating force, rather than the first, under this system, since the racist factor is the dominant motivating force among people, and sexual motivations are the second. Now, the racists, apparently, according to the evidence, have studied how people who are subject to them are motivated sexually. Now, if a male is a boy, which you are a boy, you're a little boy when you're born and whatnot, and then you get to be a bigger boy and whatnot, and at a certain point you reach what they call a certain degree of maturity, which is decided according to the social system that you have at hand, you're now entering the threshold of what they call manhood. So you go from boys to men. Females go from girls to women, and that's the normal process in most societies. So what the racists did was look at that and said, well, you when you have a system of racism, you only have one man and one woman category, and that would be the masters themselves. You can't have your victims of the system growing into manhood and womanhood. So if they start trying to be men, if they go from boys to men, now you have a problem. You have a bigger problem than you had before. When they were boys, they were completely dependent on you. They understood that they'll do your bidding, and they're easier to control. Same way with the girls who are trying to be women. But when they start thinking that they are men, you're not going to have but one man in the house of white supremacy, and he's got to be white. And you're not going to have but one woman, and she has to be white. So now it defies logic that you would allow them to go from boys to men. So if you're not going to allow them to go from boys to men, what will you allow them to do? Because they are constantly growing, they are constantly getting smarter, and they have a natural tendency to want to break away from boyhood and to become men. Say, so what you do is divert them away from wanting to become men and have, if it's a male, have him go from boyhood to femalehood. In other words, he changes his gender altogether, at least in his mind. Then he's easier to control. Then you do the same thing with the female. Take the black female, and rather than allow her to go the normal progression of things, steer her in the direction away from becoming a woman and in the direction of becoming a male. In other words, she will switch genders in her mind. Now, her body didn't switch genders, but we can probably do some things that give her the illusion that her body can be made to switch genders too. Now, when you do that, what you have is confusion. You have added confusion. And one of the best ways to control people for a long period of time, particularly if you confuse them sexually, is through confusing them sexually. So that you have a male thinking he's a female or wanting to be a female, even if he's struggling and trying and whatnot and trying to do everything that a female does, but he doesn't have the physical equipment. But he's got it in his mind anyway. He's just determined he's going to act like one and be one and do the things that females do and look at males like a female looks at males normally. And then over in the female column, have the female do the same thing. Only thing about it, she's not going to try to grow into womanhood. She's going to try to do everything that she sees males doing, including in the bedroom. Try to become an artificial male. And she can do this in her mind because the mind is very flexible. A person can actually think that they are a bird if they want to. But before they try to fly or jump off a building, it's best that they get their equipment for doing so. You know. So that's the way that works. And when you can get people on that roll and when you have people subject to you, you can always propagandize anything. You can make anything look like it's the fashion because you set the rules for the society. So that's what's going on. I tried to be as comprehensive as I possibly could in that description, and I hope that people could understand what was being said.
Yes, sir.
So that's what we have now. We're heading in that direction now, full steam ahead.
And when I spoke with you, I said that, you know, the counter-argument that I frequently hear is that, well, there are a lot of white people who are also participating in so-called homosexual activity. And, you know, this is not something where they're just trying to trick black people into doing it. You have people who are born so-called gay or homosexual, and, you know, this is no trick at all. If it was, you wouldn't see all these white people going around and doing it and being mistreated because they are participating in these so-called homosexual acts. What would your view on that be?
Depends on how it plays out in the end. Now, if the system of white supremacism remains intact, then that will prove the supposition just outlined. That will prove that it's valid, that it is designed basically to support what is already in place. Otherwise, you would have the system of white supremacy would go out of business. There would be no reason to keep it in business if the white people were serious about really getting rid of racism and getting rid of what they call all of the sexual and gender categories and all like that, because racism is an artificial category. See, just because people are of different colors doesn't say that they are members of a race. That's an artificial construct. No one is supposed to be a member of a race. That's something completely made up. So if you can do the same thing with gender. You can do the same thing with a lot of things. But you have to wait until it reaches a certain point where you got enough evidence to prove the proposition that you made in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like I say, this is my concept of the way things are going because there is still a system of racism in place. Now, if racism is still in place, when all of the so-called anti-sexual, that's what I call it, behavior,
yes,
comes to full fruition and everybody's accepting of it, everybody's participating in it or embracing it or parading it around and saying that it's the best thing ever discovered since ever, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and you still have a system of racism in place, then that will have proved the supposition, because ordinarily, all of racism would disappear. But see, it's designed to lure. Now, here's where I based that on, the luring part. In the history of the system of white supremacy, there's a thing called whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
It was very popular, the use of it. Now, if you are a practiced deceiver, one thing that you know about the science and the art of deception, you cannot deceive people into doing things unless you are doing quite a bit of it yourself. If you're going to be what you call a real arch deceiver, and the white supremacists have proven that they are arch deceivers, they are very skillful at deception. So in order to deceive people, you can't get people to drink whiskey, and you're sitting there never drinking any of it yourself. So there's some historical record of this.
Mm-hmm.
So what they'll do, a deceiver will sit there and practice drinking whiskey under controlled conditions. You know, take a little sip, know exactly where the point is where you get good and drunk, or where you don't get good and drunk. Then once you learn what they say, and some people brag about it in bars and whatnot, said, hey, I can drink you under the table, meaning they can